Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes, normal film critic. I was once a disgraced film critic, like 450 years ago, something like that. One day I just woke up, I was not disgraced anymore, and you know what? I'm just the same person as I was before, just not disgraced, okay? Still a pretentious film critic. With me as always, though, this guy, tie a yellow ribbon around him because his comedic takes, they are as strong, they as sturdy, and they are as everlasting as an old oak tree. Why, it's Corky McDonald. And also, acorns are constantly dropping off of you. Can I say this? Can we just talk about this? Because this is a rare condition that you have, and I think it needs a lot more attention.
Well, we're trying to raise money for it.
This is acorn eczema. No one ever talks about it, right? Like, you see all for Ebglyss, you see all the commercials no one ever talks about people who just randomly shed acorns from their skin, like our man Corky McDonald. In so many ways, you are like an old oak tree.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate it. For those of us who suffer with acorn scabies, it can be tough, especially this time of year. You know, you're constantly dropping new seedlings, and it's a mess. It's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable.
Wow.
So please give all you can. You'll see some of our collection plates around the stores this time of year. Man outside ringing just shaking a leaf and dropping nuts.
So look for the man dropping nuts and give him some money. So
I think that's a good rule in life. That's just look out good for the man dropping nuts.
For everyone, just moving forward, just in any situation. Corky, for an old oak tree, though,
Dan,
may I say, you are looking like a young sapling. Sir.
It's
not to flatter.
I'm an old man, but in oak tree years, buddy, I'm in my early bloom.
Don't make us cut you open and count your rings, because that could get messy.
Saturday already? Come on.
Hey, wow. Hot stuff. Hot roasted acorn.
But Dan, seriously, what is it what we do here? We talk movies.
It says we banter. Oh, after that, we talk about movies. We do eventually get into the movies. But before we do that, Corky, I think there's something very important that we do. What do you think it is?
I think it's taking a big moment. Just a big, breathy, long.
In our day, we're constantly besieged with media. It just seems as though the days aren't long enough. We never just take that moment. Let's take a moment.
Just take
right now.
The moment.
Celebrate.
Moments of your life.
A moment, right? Jesus.
Wrap your hands around a warm tea mug. Get that favorite cardigan out of the closet.
Come back to us. Here. We're here.
Gaze out the window.
Just look at a sunset. Is the sun setting? It's not important. Look at it.
It's rising. It's setting.
Look at the sun.
You don't know.
Yeah.
Look at the sun. Well, that's what, I mean, if there's an overarching message to our podcast, it's go stare at the sun for a bit.
What? Why not? I mean,
you're too good for the sun now?
Oh, wow. Okay. Jesus, unbelievable. First, too good for a moment, now for the sun. But before
we get to somewhere lost in there, in that miasma of garbage that we spew, we want to thank our PayPal supporters, the donors, the heroes, the sunrise.
The sun that we all revolve around. That they are the
life-giving nourishment
of our podcast universe. They nourish us. We revolve around them. They are made of fire.
Couldn't do it without them.
Yeah.
Yes.
These are our donors. These are amazing people.
They're
millions of miles away
from
support. Earth. That's unbelievable stuff. If you'd like to donate to the show, become one of the heroes, join our league of heroes, head to daredaniel.com, find the menu at the top of the page, click support the show, or find the donate button on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation or a monthly donation. Any contribution you make helps keep this show going. This is episode 56 of Cannon Fodder. Mm. We're an episode. We did 120 some episodes of Dare Daniel. There's other things. I'm doing Single Take. I just recorded my second episode of that. I don't know where we are when this comes out, but I'll have several more episodes by then. The donors, man, they, you know, it doesn't take much, but it does help keep this show going, and they've kept it going for nigh on, what, 7, 8 years now, whatever? Yeah,
amazing. Yeah, 8 years, buddy. Tonight, we're talking Orlando, Sally Potter's 1992 film starring Tilda Swinton. The IMDb synopsis for Orlando: after Queen Elizabeth I commands him not to grow old, a young nobleman struggles with love and his place in the world.
Yes, this week's film, it's Orlando, written and directed by Sally Potter. What house do you think Sally Potter's in at Hogwarts? Potter, get it. Classic Hufflepuff. Who also co-composed the score, Sally Potter. It's based on the 1928 Virginia Woolf novel, Orlando: A Biography, and stars Tilda Swinton in the title role. Potter had been making films since she was a teenager. She became a renowned performance artist and theater director, but Orlando was the film that put her on the map as a director. She spent about 7 years trying to get the film to the screen. The novel was long considered unadaptable, considering the subject matter and scope, and they struggled to secure funding for the film. It was shot and edited over 20 weeks, including scenes shot in Uzbekistan, which stood in for Constantinople. It premiered September 1st, 1992 at the Venice Film Festival and saw more of a wider release in 1993. It was kind of a hit in its own kind of small way, grossing $13 million worldwide against a $4 million budget. Of course, a movie this singular is never going to receive universal praise, but it's always had a huge fan base, and its legacy has endured even well beyond cinema. Certainly, it's a watershed film about gender identity, but also the labyrinth scene apparently inspired the 2020 Spring Exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Met Gala. And as we talked about last episode, when Orlando was randomly selected, it's the film that introduced a lot of people to Tilda Swinton. Though she'd appeared in several Derek Jarman films like Caravaggio and Edward II, this was kind of the first big exposure, big starring role for her. The movie was also nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Costume Design and Best Art Direction. And while we're on costumes, another Derek Jarman veteran whose star shot up because of this film is costume designer Sandy Powell. We don't often talk about the below-the-line folks here on the podcast, but she does deserve special praise because I think the costumes go a long way towards elevating the pageantry of this film. Sandy Powell, she got her first Oscar nomination for Orlando. It was the first of 15, including 3 wins. She's worked with a lot of great directors, worked with Scorsese 6 times, Todd Haynes multiple times, Julie Taymor, Mike Figgis. She's literally one of the best who's ever done it. And again, this is the film that put her on the map. Again, just like Tilda Swinton, one of the all-time greats.
Yes, sir.
On the map. Corky.
Yeah.
Orlando, I'm going to make it simple for you. Magic Kingdom or Tragic Kingdom?
It's hard to find a movie more my jam than some Powdered Wig.
You do love Powdered Wig lechery. That is something that's on your, like, auteur, you know, that your cinephile card says, like, you know, special interest
Powdered Wig lechery. Give me some snide, crass scheming of some, you know, refined people sitting around dressed to the hilt. This movie looks so good. It's the costuming is just, I'm not surprised to see that it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. And those were the ones I would say, costume design and art direction. Jesus Christ. Every location is impressive when they're supposed to be impressive and regal. And they surround you with the elements sometimes. But, you know, it's very languidly shot, if that makes sense. Even the big presentation pieces aren't ostentatious about it. It's just like, wow, it's this imposing of scope and the necessary, you know, deference due to this location. But then there's a lot of tight, simple close-ups on people in just sand dunes or, you know, in a bathhouse, something like that.
They it was a low budget production, as I said, $4 million. So there's, mm-hmm. but it's, there is this sense of spectacle, but it's yeah. like this subdued sense of spectacle, right? It's like they spent really wisely. They're like, where can we spend here? We need to really make sure the costumes are great. We need to make sure yeah. the production design is spot on. Like, that's where we can actually do some things. Otherwise, like, we can't have like hundreds of people like at our beck and call. We can have like a dozen or so people at our beck and call. And so they shoot around that in a very creative way to make it seem like there's a big bazaar.
Yes.
Really, there's probably like 10 and people or something in the shot.
I think that the way it's shot, it made me think of a Dare Daniel movie that may surprise you that I thought of it, but Revolution with Al Pacino as the fur trapper. Because like that was running... Oh. Chasing mud, running, shouting mud. But it was like real, like the scenes at night were mm-hmm. dark unless they were torchlit. The scenes at night at this are dark unless they're torchlit. It's a lot of natural light. It's not overbearing light. It's not, I watched the recent Count of Monte Cristo, which I really liked. But this looks like it stepped right out of that time. The people are freezing when they're in the cold, right? Mm-hmm. They're next to a stone building that still has water damage in it if it gets too cold. Like, water spots show up on the building. So it's really impressive in the place setting of it. And fantastical, a joyous watch. It never quite got over the hump to me. It never went to the transcendent place as a film. Mm-hmm. Tilda Swinton's great. The story is great. The look of it yeah. is, I would say the star of the show is the look of it. But as a movie, it never did the thing that made it the most memorable, canon-worthy movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much right there with you. I kind of love the first about two-thirds of this film. And then in the third act, it does get a little bit dreary. I have to say, Billy Zane... And I don't want to just blame Billy Zane because it's a really poorly written character. And this sequence is just really, really deadly. We'll get to it eventually. But it falters in the third act. I love Tilda Swinton. She's so remarkable at making Orlando like so tantalizing to us and yet
yes.
so vapid of a person and being non-egotistical about that, right? It's really great like how like goofy she's willing to be. There's this constant like fourth yeah. wall breaking going on where she gazes at the audience
Fleabag
and
style.
Will share an inner thought with us. It's this great device. It's building, yeah, right. It's building empathy with a character who doesn't have like human properties, doesn't age, spontaneously changes sex, spontaneously reproduces, right? Like, that's not a person you have like instant empathy with, but it builds empathy. However, the kind of flip side of that is that Orlando never has anything to say. That's what's this like big joke of the film is that like in the first scene, we see Orlando reciting some poetry and staring at a blank page. And that turns out to be right. Orlando's this real blank page. And for all that Orlando experiences, all these amazing things of living across the centuries and being both man and a woman and experiencing motherhood and all these other kinds of things. What does Orlando actually learn? Every time Orlando turns to the camera and shares the thought, it's like something amazing and magical happens. And then Orlando's like, wow, that's really interesting. He was like, that's that 400 years. That's what you got. That's what you got. Like, he meant like, it's like, it takes Orlando 250 years to discover sex, man.
Yeah.
Like, when he's a male, Orlando is the most toxic fucking male. Orlando is a classic incel as a male. He has to change to a woman to become a better person. Loves poetry, but is a terrible writer and has absolutely no insights to share. Only just whining about himself. Not intelligent, not really talented. Keeps getting opportunities, though. Like, amazing opportunities. Why?
Yeah.
Wealth, beauty, and youth. And these are the real three, like, staples of Orlando. Is that completely wealthy, young, and beautiful his entire life.
I never took Orlando as incel energy, which I guess I kind of put a negative connotation to that. More himbo, more just rich, privileged, doesn't know shit about fuck, and is going to succeed in spite of all of that.
Well, how about this, though? When Orlando first discovers love in the sequence called Love, they're kind of broken up into these single word title sequences. He becomes obsessed with this Cossack princess. They get snowed in.
Sure.
In England. Snow everywhere, right? Orlando falls in love, completely forgets his position. He says to her, "You're mine because I adore you." And then when she leaves, because the ice thaw, he literally blames the thawing of ice on the treachery of women while ignoring cries for help. And it's constantly just like, yeah, like these women, they're not like us. They're not like us fellows. He has online incel. I don't know exactly what's going on there. But yeah, he is a very toxic male. And as soon as he becomes a woman, about halfway through the film, he rejects those ideas, right? But again, not any higher calling or anything like that. It's just like he's seeing it from another side, but I don't know if it's actually necessarily building empathy. And anyway, if it does, it takes like literally centuries for this to happen. Like these incels would need to be alive for like 300
that's a
years
good counterpoint
before they would ever like learn a fucking thing. So anyway, yeah, like I said, the film's broken up into these like these kind of mini chapters, and the first chapter is called Death, and this is where he meets Queen Elizabeth. And Queen Elizabeth is played by Quentin Crisp. And if you don't know Quentin Crisp, I think was it the Naked Policeman or something? He's a very well known of the era gay writer. And a figure in that era, for sure. I think Terrence Stamp played him in a biopic fairly recently.
Oh.
Quentin Crisp. So, the Naked Civil Servant, is that it? Anyway, whatever.
I don't know.
Somebody's naked. That's all I know. But he plays Queen Elizabeth I. It's really fantastic casting here as this very desiccated Queen Elizabeth I. And there's a great sequence of her arriving on a boat, and this kind of what sounds like a castrato singer is like serenading her on another boat as she kind of comes in. Again, it's just this like sense of spectacle, but it's not like gigantic CGI crowds kind of spectacle. It's just like, here's this one boat, and then we got another boat. But it just looks beautiful because of the location, because it's lit by torches, because it's just so well mounted. But yeah, so the Queen Elizabeth kind of takes young Orlando as she calls him my mascot. She wants him as her mascot, right? And this is like, it's just interesting that he kind of learns about like power and kind of bending people to your will and bending countries to your will from Queen Elizabeth, of course, who's the most powerful person in the world and as a woman, and then brings that to Orlando, and he kind of takes that out in the world. But basically they make a deal, which is that he'll be rich forever, but he has to promise to never grow old. She basically just turns him into a vampire with this contract.
And there's it's a very sexy scene. Like,
yeah.
As much sexual chemistry as Tilda Swinton could have with 90-year-old Quentin Crisp. But Queen Elizabeth is seducing Orlando without the sex part. It's, I'm seducing you into this world of privilege, of everlasting beauty, and youth. You'll get everything you want, but you're kind of punished.
Yeah, it's just like she wants him. And she wants it. It's a little bit of like what we saw in The Favorite. The film with Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz. You know, it's just like, he's just kind of currying favor. She's the queen. She decides this.
Yeah.
And so her servants are going to undress her, put her into bed. And then her mascot, you know, Orlando, who is the son of the people whose castle she is staying at right now, and he's just going to be there in her bed. Even though, again, she's, you know, 70 years old, 80 years old. She's not attractive at all. He's very young and comely. And this is kind of like where this, I think, goes out larger to the political world of like saying, I'm England and I want you. And therefore, you're mine. And that's that. And that's all. That's the only thing that needs to happen, right? She wants Orlando. And so he's hers, even though Orlando's family is very powerful. Now, so then Orlando goes down to whoever's next down below him and says, now you're mine, right? And then later on, when he's a woman, the Archduke says, I'm England and I want you and you're mine, right? Like the exact same thing he says to her. But this is just like the sort of trickle down and sort of spreading this idea of, I'm rich, I'm powerful, I get to do whatever the fuck I want. And so if you're a little less rich and powerful, but still rich, more rich and powerful than other people, you get to do whatever you want to them, and on down and on down and on down and on down and on down. It's like that welcome to the dollhouse, like mentality of bullying, you know, like somebody's lower than you, right? And you'll find that person and take a shit on them. Anyway, yeah. So she dies and basically leaves him to live forever. And then kind of we go to the next one, and it's his father's funeral procession. So now Orlando's alone in the world. And this is, again, an amazing scene. It's just like, it's so intimate and small in its way, but it has this sort of epic feel, this funeral procession through the snow, and it's all these people in black against the white snow, and they're moving very slowly, and it's this gorgeous music, and it's just like, it's just a beautiful, beautiful scene. There's so many of these scenes in this opening part of the film, and I love this. Might be my favorite sequence of the film, this whole sequence on ice, where England has this like new ice age has just spread over England. And everyone's on ice skates, right? Like the waiters are on ice skates, people who don't know how to ice, you know, this, if, but there's a rich guy and people are laying blankets before him so he can walk on the ice. And it's just all of these.
And before
like,
that, before that, there's a shot where he's laughing at what obviously someone fell in the ice. This poor young woman fell in the ice and all her apples floated out of her basket and she's frozen dead below the ice, and he's just laughing. And it's the casual cruelty and the casual indifference of people who were rich and privileged and poor who were subjects of mockery. And then the guy walks away and they're actually laying blankets on the ice for him, lest his feet be moistened or cold in any way.
Right, while laughing at this woman who just spontaneously froze at us out of nowhere, who was just shocked by, and they're laughing about a story about another person who was left out in the cold and who was like literally obliterated into nothingness, you know, and they think how hilarious that is. But it's that, that again becomes kind of like part of a larger thing, I think, once Orlando gets into politics eventually. Yeah. So there's this whole princess thing. He loves her. She goes away. And then Orlando decides poetry. That's it, right? Well, first he goes into this deep sleep. Every time he's really wounded by something, Orlando goes into a deep, deep, deep sleep. But then we get this sequence with the poor poet who is seeking a benefactor and is so like, is so blatant about it, is so obsequious about it, and then
just could not be more obvious.
Right? He's just like scraping the plate, trying to get as much as he possibly can, and just saying, oh, I need a pension. Takes the pension, looks at it. I mean, this is just the only reason Orlando's giving this pension is because Orlando wants to be a poet and wants to find some respectable poet who will come and read his poetry and tell him how brilliant it is. Well, laughs at it, mocks it openly, and then writes a poem telling him how terrible he is. Right? Like, it's like, this is the guy. And Orlando still pays the pension. But I mean, it's just, this is like the theme with Orlando, is like Orlando has nothing to offer. You know, again, except for these things that have been frozen in time, right? Orlando had something, like if Queen Elizabeth had never done this, right? Orlando would just eventually grow old, right? And, you know, move on and be rich and whatever. But, like, it's always young, always beautiful, always wealthy. You know, this is why the things keep happening. So now we move to the next section, which is politics.
I'm going to back up real quick and kind of give it to you about the whole incel kind of thing. He's also throwing over someone who he was promised to or had promised to marry for this Russian princess. And you get to see the dynamics of this is something this woman may never live down.
Yeah.
Just being promised to someone and then them choosing someone else. But he can get away with it. He's a man, a rich man in that era. He can get away with that, doing that kind of
thing. And not even think about it. Not even consider, what does this mean for this woman? You know, what happens to her? You know, and obviously, you know, most likely nothing good. Yeah, all the opportunities are for the men, but the men strive to look like women. That the like androgyny is like the like high quality,
very common.
Like if you are a real man, has like a very long powdered curly wig and a lot of frills and a lot of other things. So he asked to be an ambassador to the East, and because he's rich as fuck, he's an ambassador to the East. That's how that works, right? The owner of the New York Jets, wasn't he an ambassador to England?
Yeah.
Why not?
Absolutely.
I'm rich. Make me a fucking ambassador. Sounds good.
Shirley Temple Black.
There you go. So he heads to the East and finds another man who hates women, I guess, a little more romantic of a view of it. He says that he's a casualty of love. What I love here is that this is kind of a piece with the ice skating sequence. They're out in the desert. They're in the middle of nowhere, right? Toasting in full dress.
Yeah.
Toasting with champagne. There's all this pomp and all this luxury, and it's brought to the most stark locations. Like, it doesn't matter that there's an ice age and nothing's accessible. That's all right. The waiters are now on ice skates doing like routines while delivering our dinner. You know, like, it's just whatever they want, they get wherever they want it. Yeah, it just keeps happening over and over again here. And this is a really another great scene, just like the ice scene. But, like, again, for Orlando, you know, 10 years fly by in a gulp. The Archduke of England shows up. He's shocked to find Orlando's sort of, like, gone native a little bit for these 10 years. Off comes the wig. On comes the turban.
John Wood was really good in this role. Mm-hmm. I really liked him as Harry. Archduke
He's
Harry.
Excellent. Yeah. Again, he is classic England. He is classic England, you know, whatever England wants, England gets. So they have this ceremony for Orlando. Congratulations on 10 years, but Orlando's, you know, friend, quote unquote, the head of whoever. I don't know. It's not really clear who any of these people are, but he asks for help in this battle.
Maharaji, something like that.
Whatever's happening in this battle, the barbarians are at the gate. He wants help. And Orlando's brief experience with war, which basically is just watching one person get shot, an enemy who's about to kill them, and then no one really caring, this shakes him like so deeply, right? Like so deeply that he once again falls into deep sleep and wakes up a woman, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think like it's like, again, what I think is funny is like how sensitive Orlando is and how like kind of like weak Orlando is. Like, this is a common thing of like from, you know, The Sun Also Rises and Mrs. Dalloway and all these other books about like people, movies about men who've gone off to war and they've been horribly harmed by it, either like in a physical way or in a mental way, and they're carrying these scars with them out they go and they've never quite recovered from it. She literally just looked like Orlando looks at it for like 10 seconds, just like, oh yeah. War, oh, that's war, okay, like I'm not a man anymore. Like, just wakes up a woman. Like, that's how like little provocation it takes for Orlando. It's not like, Orlando was in the trenches, you know, in no man's land for several weeks or anything like that. But yeah, she wakes up and that's it. She's a woman. Same person, no difference at all, just a different sex. And enters mm-hmm. society now as a woman, wearing women's clothes and wigs still, but women's wigs. And just comes back to her home as a woman. And it's like, again, too rich for anyone to say anything. Too rich for anyone to even like bother with it. Like, what are the servants going to say? Like, no?
Yeah.
You know, like, what's their place there, right? So once again, Orlando is fascinated by literature and kind of goes to this. There's this whole scene in the literary salon where she meets Pope and Swift. And this is where, like, they're giving their views of women, which are, you know, of the 18th century, mid-18th century. And they're horrible, absolutely horrible, of course. But Orlando would have expressed the exact same things as a man and now, like, rejects this opinion.
But this was there was a really funny line here where they're explaining, now that you're legally dead, you can't own any land. Yeah. And also a woman, and then someone interjects like, that's the same thing legally. Which is, it's a shit, but it's a good line.
Yeah, it really is. You know,
the way
is,
it's sold.
So yeah, there's all these lawsuits pertaining to me, because as a woman, Orlando doesn't have power, can't own property. The Archduke, who has fallen in love, you know, fell in love with the male Orlando, let's be honest, but now that it's a female Orlando, he's like, okay, that's now I'm in. He proposes on the spot, I am England and you are mine, and she rejects him. And this is where we get like the famous labyrinth scene, these amazing shots of Orlando running through this kind of fog shrouded labyrinth. Again, the music gets very rapturous. Orlando, you know, we get another big leap in time ahead, another, I think, 100 years, actually. 100 years in the labyrinth. I mean, geez.
Yeah, Jack Torrance did
way better than that.
What are you, a minotaur?
And this is also... this is an amazing scene, the labyrinth scene. But what comes out of the labyrinth scene and where the film goes for me is really where the film fell apart for me. So... sex is the title of this sequence, and sex equals Billy Zane on a horse, and that I have no issue with whatsoever. Right. But Billy Zane is quite bad here. It's pretty Fabio-esque, I think, his how he's presented.
It
literally is like
it's cover of a romance
novel. She falls to the ground. He falls right next to her, and like so she says, like right away, "Will you marry me?" Mm-hmm. Like right away. And this is like, again, this is where the low budget part of the movie comes in, is where we hear planes and trains and things, but don't actually see them. So we hear a train, and Orlando, who again, you know, it was 1750 when Orlando went in the labyrinth. It's 1850 now. Locomotives have been invented. But we don't actually see the train. We see it, we get a puff of smoke, and like, what's that? And Billy Zane says, the future. This is like his whole thing as a character is like, I'm fighting for the future, and I'm in the future, and I'm gonna go to the future, and you're in the past. I mean, it's so fucking, it's really insipid. It's really, and I just, it really feels like the film kind of falls, kind of,
yeah,
goes off the rails, to use a locomotive term. But he finally deflowers Orlando, who apparently hasn't had sex again for 250 years at this point.
And then that's all Orlando wants to do,
right?
It's Bridgerton up in there.
Oh boy, yeah. I mean, that's the way it goes. You know, two or three centuries without sex, and then you have sex.
Sure,
it's just like, oh, gotta have a release. You become obsessed
as a young oak. I can concur.
250 years is nothing to you. But yes, it's like stay in the past or go to America and the future, which all of a sudden is the imperative of Orlando as this kind of plays out in the third act. Billy Zane says, my love is for mankind. I must fight for the future. And then a wind blows and he goes off of the wind. I mean, it's all like really, really stupid. And then there's this whole scene of like, it's the modern world and there's planes. And then she's running across a battlefield while pregnant. I don't know where any of this was. I don't know what any of this was. But it just didn't work. It really didn't work.
The end, it felt like The Wall, the movie, the Pink Floyd movie, The Wall, yeah. That's just a series of vignettes of things. They were not set to music or anything. It just didn't tie together. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of slapdash after all the what it had built before.
Yeah, I know. I do agree. And apparently the novel Orlando does go up to modern times of when it was written, which was the 1920s. This goes up to the modern times of the 90s. So we get a full and final leap forward to birth and this transition to modern day where Orlando is now selling her memoir. Orlando has a daughter. They return to the old house, which I thought was interesting. They go back to the house from the beginning, which is covered up with all these kind of white sheets, but it sort of resembles like the ice covered world we saw earlier. Like it's this house, it's familiar, but it's shrouded in white. There's modern music on the soundtrack. And then the narration comes in at the end. She is no longer trapped by her destiny. And for me, that was a sense of I'm hearing it, but I'm not really feeling it. And that's kind of where this third act went for me. And where I think kind of Sally Potter's career goes sort of from Orlando on is more, you can explain it, but that doesn't mean I'm going to really actually feel it. But we get, it's a really cool last sequence and kind of a surprising final shot, I think. I loved where this landed in the final
It didn't. No, it did less than nothing for me. It looked like the flying pig from Kids in the Hall.
Love that. Yeah, special effects wise, I have some problems with it, sure, but I think it's a
really didn't get any of this part. Like, didn't land for me.
It did for
me. I like the guy from Bronski Beat. I like him, but I wasn't digging what was happening.
Yeah. And we won't spoil it for anyone who does want to see Orlando because it's another, it's again, it's sort of like, much like I said with the old house, it's a callback to Orlando's beginning back in 1600. And at this point, we're in the almost to 2000. So it's been 400 years. So anyway, I thought it was interesting and seeing it through the now digital lens of her. And with her daughter as now the auteur of it as well. So anyway, thought that was interesting as sort of a moving forward kind of thing. But understand if that did not work for you. But mostly, like I said, most of the third act doesn't really work for me. But I love the first two thirds of it so much that I still really think this is a great film. So let's remind everybody about our rating system. We rate on the slight or sound scale. If we both think it was a sound selection, then kaboom, into the cannon fodder, cannon it goes. If one or both of us think it was a little bit slight, no cannon for you, but we'll select a slighted movie, not in the sight and sound top 250 to put in its place. Corky, Orlando, slight or sound?
I got to go slight, unfortunately. The movie that introduced us to Tilda Swinton, and thankful for that. I loved a lot of I love her and so much, and I did really like this movie, but it's just it's not personal canon worthy.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen it a few times now. I saw it when it came out in the early 90s. I think I saw it again in a college class. But it's probably been at least 25 years since I've seen it. I think it holds up in its way as sort of like as an art film. I think it holds up as a visual piece, as again, as like a very unique and pretty groundbreaking take on gender identity. I think it's very interesting. But yeah, it does fall apart in that third act for me, and it doesn't quite hit that level of canon worthy. It's a movie I would highly recommend. I think it's a really good movie, and I'll probably see it a fourth time, maybe in another 20 or 30 years. But not in the canon. So, Corky, do you have a slighted film not in the Sight and Sound Top 250 to put in its place?
Yeah, it's one I've recommended before. Yorgos Lanthimos is The Favorite. We didn't canonize it because it's too recent. I expect we won't again, but I'm gonna keep voting for this.
Keep pitching.
I'm gonna keep pitching. I'm gonna try to sell this.
Elevator pitch.
But I get it. You know, Bill Belichick didn't make the Hall of Fame on his first entrance. Maybe The Favorite is not the favorite to get in this year, but it's gonna get in. It's the same set or costume designer who's just amazing. Everything's up a notch in this one compared to Orlando, but that's why it reminds me of Orlando. There's also the kind of gender fluidity and sex fluidity in it. Compelling story, beautiful spectacle, acting fucking on an S-tier level, and you got Lanthimos, you got no complaints with the whole visualosity of it.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel you, and I absolutely love Yorgos Lanthimos, The Favorite. Interesting, maybe it's not interesting, but I'll tell you anyway. I have actually read the original script for The Favorite, which I guess was something that had kind of been around for a little while before Yorgos finally got on and got a hold of it and made it his own. But what's really interesting about the script is that, like, a lot of the really kind of, like, weirder, you know, aspects of it were added by Lanthimos. All of the kind of visual touches and things. The script itself, it is like a diamond. It is just like tight as a freaking drum. It is one of the most just like bullet hard scripts that I have ever read. See, not that I've read a ton of scripts, but I've read my share, and it's an absolute.
That's the kind of thing, though. What Orlando is missing. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing. Like, a great script, tight script delivers, but you have someone adding this other piece, and it just becomes memorable and canon-worthy for me.
Yeah, well, or maybe Orlando just has all the other pieces but lacks the Diamond Hard script element of it.
Good point, yeah.
Well, I got a suggestion as well. I was going to pull out what this movie... This is a kind of a weird tie-in, but it made me think a little bit, especially all of the Tilda Swinton looking at the camera, looking at us, looking right at us, especially that final sequence where there's about a 20 or 30 second unbroken shot of not talking, no quips, no anything, just Tilda just staring into our souls, my God. Mm-hmm. It made me think of Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, and the alien kind of stares into our soul at the end of that movie as well. And again, there is this kind of like sexual, all these kind of dynamics going on. However, that's already in the Sight and Sound Top 250. So good job, everybody. So I'll mention a film that I thought visually reminded me of Orlando, even if maybe not thematically or in any necessarily any other ways. So it was made around the same time too, but a little film by Terry Gilliam. I think there is a Gilliam-esque quality to the costumes.
I thought the same thing.
Architecture of the costumes to like kind of the grotesquerie of, you know, some of the people in the some of the royals and some of the people in the background and things like that. So it especially made me think of his film The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is one of those films that I saw on cable about 300 times in part or in full as a child. It was just one of those films that was on all the time. And of course, it's just like a nonstop explosion of like crazy effects and costumes and makeup and performances, and it's just one over-the-top sequence after another. I mean, it's a hell of a film. You're familiar with The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen it. It's been decades since I've seen it, but I've seen it.
It's been a while since I've seen it as well, and it's another film that, like Orlando, although Orlando is linear, you know, again, the Baron sort of ages, de-ages, unages, re-ages, you know, it kind of goes back and forth on, you know, who he is as well. And I think it's also just the sort of sense of spectacle is there. He had a much bigger budget on Baron Munchausen, Gilliam did, but I think that it's almost as though Orlando is shooting for, like, what is the low budget version we can do of, like, a Baron Munchausen-esque world. There's even, again, that trip to the Middle East there, right?
Just
as Baron Munchausen has his adventures in the Ottoman Empire.
That's what made me think of Baron Munchausen.
Yeah, absolutely. It was also nominated for Best Art Direction and Best Costume Design at the Oscars as well. It was released in 1988. If you don't know it, it stars John Neville, Eric Idle, a crazy young child star, Sarah Polley, crazy young Uma Thurman as well, Oliver Reed, Jonathan Pryce, great cast. Visually, one of the most outstanding movies you're ever going to see. All right, so there's two films out there, The Favorite, which you suggested, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which I suggested. Corky, I'm going to throw my lot in on The Favorite. I think it's a fantastic film. I think I needed to sit with it a while, but I'm going all in on The Favorite. So let's add that to the Cannon Potter canon. I feel
great no.
about this. Yeah, let's do it.
You've just made me the happiest boy.
Best boy. I should hope to.
We are getting something in tonight, and it is The Favorite.
Oh, yeah. I love that. And no expectations of quid pro quo, especially if you feel like you haven't seen this film in a long time. But I've always loved
it. I haven't, but I think I should give it a rewatch.
Give it a rewatch. Let's just press pause on it. Give it a rewatch. Maybe we'll revisit it later this year at the end of the year when we kind of collect unwatched films as well. But that is one entry into the canon this week. Unfortunately, it's not Orlando, which is a movie I think we both really, really liked, but there's a super high bar for getting into the canon, and it didn't quite meet it. The Favorite, however, clears the bar and makes it into the Cannon Fodder canon.
That's what we thought about Orlando and The Favorite and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. But what did you think about Orlando? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at DareDanielPod. Tell us your thoughts.
All right. Now it's time to select the film we'll be reviewing in 2 weeks on our next episode. And of course, as always, we'll do it by selecting a number at random. You ready to do this, Corky?
Let's go.
And off we go into A Wild Blue Yonder. And what do you got for us? We got a brief encounter. Brief Encounter, 1945 British film, directed by David Lean, starring Celia Johnson, Trevor Howard, and Stanley Holloway. I'll read the IMDb synopsis. Meeting a stranger in a railway station, a woman is tempted to cheat on her husband. Corky, are you at all familiar with Brief Encounter?
No. Haven't heard of Brief Encounter.
Okay. Well, you it's co-written by Noel Coward, who I'm sure you have at least heard of.
Yep, heard of him.
Directed by David Lean. This is, I mean, you know David
heard
Lean from like Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia. This is like the early David Lean back in Britain. This is 1945, towards the end of World War II. And this is just one of the most famous, like, kind of romances of all time, or thwarted romances of all time. I've seen the film. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I thought it was okay first time, but also it's one of those movies that maybe being in my late 40s as opposed to my mid 20s or whenever I saw that might have a slightly different view on it now. It might be something that maybe
also, if we're being honest, they go a little tender on their own in the BFI Sight and Sound. So this might be, you know, this eighth Archer film.
they do love the Brits. But this is a movie that is considered one of the all-time. Well, obviously it's considered one of the all-time greats because it's on this list. I'm excited to see it again. If you would like to follow along at home, the film is available on the Criterion channel. Of course, you know we love that Criterion channel. But it's pretty easy to find elsewhere as well. It's on HBO Max. You can watch it free with ads on Plex, on Pluto TV, on the Roku channel. It's available for rent on all of your usual VOD services. It shows on Turner Classic Movies, you know, like once every month or so. So it's a not a hard film to find. So join us in a couple of weeks to listen as we review Brief Encounter. 86 minutes.
Fucking, come on.
Are you kidding me? Wait, you can't find 86 minutes out of your day? It's Celia Johnson.
Come on. I've stared at the sun for 86 minutes today. You can do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, if for the other 4 minutes, because if you got 90 free minutes, stare at the sun. Stare at the sun.
Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit DareDaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes saying save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.